this story about the prince and the rhinoceros comes from India, and it is taught in a program called Teaching Tolerance, and it is also on the UUA website for Tapestry of Faith, one of the programs available for our young people. Once upon a time in India, a rare rhinoceros was born, with skin so beautiful it almost glowed. The rhinoceros was given to a noble prince who was very lonely and whose kingdom was poor. The prince was delighted with the unusual gift, and he laughed joyfully, and so he named the little rhino calf Great Joy. The prince treated the rhino with great kindness. He fed her rice and fruit and tender plants, and he always spoke in a kind and gentle voice. Great Joy grew and was happy. The prince thought Great Joy was beautiful. At sunrise, she would be golden. At sunset, she would have a canvas of pink and red and orange, and later, dark blue of evening. Sometimes after a rain, she reflected everything around her. She seemed enchanted. "You are wonderful and special to me," the prince whispered softly. In time, of course, Great Joy grew into an enormous rhinoceros, and she was very strong. One day she thought about her good life with the prince and about what she could give him and his kingdom in return. "I'm only a rhino, but I could use my strength to earn some gold for his kingdom because he has none." So she suggested this to the prince, that she compete in a strength of contest against the town's strongest bulls. And a rich merchant in town with many fine oxen agreed to the wager. Great Joy would pull 100 loaded wagons, usually towed by his team of 8 oxen. The bet was 1,000 gold pieces. Well, the next day the prince inspected the wagons and harnessed Great Joy to the front. And he climbed up into the driver's seat. Great Joy waited for those kind words of encouragement. And instead, the prince, thinking only of the gold, waved a whip in the air and shouted, "Pull, you big wretch, move, you worthless rhino." Great Joy was shocked that the prince would speak to her this way. "I'm not worthless." She stiffened her legs and refused to move an inch. Humiliated, the prince ran home and hid in his bed. "I'm ruined," he cried. He didn't have the money to pay the wager that he had lost. And Great Joy was filled with pain and sorrow. She needed to understand why she deserved such cruel insults. After many days and nights without food or sleep, she went to the prince's palace, which had grown shabby over the years. "Prince, in all our years together, have I ever done anything to hurt you?" "No, never." "Then why did you say those terrible things to me? Was the thought of gold worth more than what I can offer?" The prince hung his head. Tears ran down his face. "The gold distracted me. I forgot the importance of our friendship. I'm so ashamed." "Oh, well, we'll try again then," Joy said. "Go back to the merchant, double your bet." And again the carts were loaded and Great Joy was harnessed to the front. The prince climbed up and sang out, "Oh, all right, you marvelous marvel, you splendid rhino, my Great Joy, it's up to you." And the powerful rhino snorted and pawed the ground and charged forward. Her sides heaved as she pulled until the last cart crossed the finish line. The townspeople cheered wildly. They covered her with flowers. The prince collected his 2,000 pieces of gold and then humbly thanked Great Joy for a job well done. That very evening, the prince and the rhino walked along the river in the red glow of sunset. "I didn't mean to say such hurtful words to you," the prince whispered. "Please forgive me." I already have, said Great Joy. And that is how they live to this day, in friendship and great joy. And they try to never have an unkind word pass between them. I love that story from India about the prince and the rhinoceros. Not least because a rhinoceros, as essentially a house pet, is so disarming. And I love that the prince is so fond of a creature who is not human, and yet they communicate so well. And I love that they work it out when they fail each other. They could have simply parted ways after that fateful race day, but they were both so attached to each other that even when things failed, they chose their connection over any hurt that had occurred. And I have noticed over the years that in the sort of dominant white Protestant culture that we live in New England, that it doesn't always go like that. That sometimes when we fail each other or we have misunderstandings or mistakes, that sometimes we assume that there's some fundamental problem with the relationship rather than something that we can use the relationship to overcome. I know that I, myself, do this. If something happens, I will assume that the other person will want to walk away because I have failed in some way, and that that failing is more important than any previous connection. And when someone fails me, I know I have to wrestle sometimes with the part of my mind that decides, well, that's not going to work out. Perhaps you recognize that tone, hopefully not only from me. What would it be like if we lived in a world that always put human connections first and viewed the moments when we inevitably fail each other as times to return to the relationship and use that relationship to repair whatever failing has occurred? This is, of course, a complicated proposal to put out in community and not something that we can step into entirely, you know, this holiday weekend. And folks in our community are all over the map about this. Some of you are very skilled at staying connected with other people when there are disappointments and misunderstandings. And some folks have a very low tolerance for it and back away quickly when either someone fails them or when they fail someone else. We all have different capacities to repair a hurt relationship. And what if we could remember at all moments that we make a claim for the inherent worth and dignity of all people, ourselves included? What if we kept coming back to that, even when there had been failings? It is, I think, one of our religious inheritances in this Protestant wing of things, to be more inclined to be concerned about being right than about being close. I think I've said that before, and some of you have said yes, and some of you have said no, which is how it is in community. We get to navigate this spectrum of things. And it is my observation that if you are middle class, this preoccupation with being right rather than close can be a little tighter. And then, of course, we come not only from different classes in our congregation, but different religious backgrounds. So if you were, say, Hindu, as the rhino and the prince in the story probably are, Or if you are someone who follows Christopher's story from last week and have a Catholic background or a Jewish one, you have a slightly different set of thoughts about how you respond when there is a failure or a mistake, which I think is one of the great beauties of Unitarian Universalism. We get to mix those together and come up with some different responses to the world. And that, I think, is where the growing can begin. When we learn from each other, when we watch and see that there are other possibilities for how we respond to each other, how we respond to ourselves when there is a failure. One of my colleagues wrote this week about a moment in his own congregation's life that they had to sort out. Some youth in his congregation had gotten up to tell some Unitarian Universalist jokes about, we'll have to have a service about Unitarian Universalist jokes. Well, these they had written themselves, which made that especially delightful, except that they had used a form for the jokes that is, it turns out, a little bit racist. They hadn't intended to be racist, but the format of the joke was one of those, "Yo mama is so," and then you fill in the blank. And they told a bunch of Unitarian Universalist jokes that way. And he said, when they started to tell the jokes, he had that moment, and you know this moment, when your heart goes, because you know that something isn't right. But he was sitting, I think, in the pews, and the jokes were being told up front, and turned out that they were kind jokes about Unitarian Universalists, and he thought, well, it's probably all right. So he posted them on his blog, and he got some responses about the fact that this form of telling jokes is racist. And as soon as he heard that response from people, he thought, oh yeah, I know that. That's what that little loop in my heart was telling me. So he took the jokes down, and he has been engaged in a conversation ever since. He says, I feel terrible about this. And that's the next pointer for his series of how we grow from our mistakes. To notice the feelings. The first feeling I should have caught was that feeling of, he calls it hesitation, that moment when your heart skips a little. It would have been pretty easy to reframe those jokes into another format, like, you might be you if. And my takeaway feeling of guilt about what happened, at how I did and did not do things in another moment, were the heart leading the way. We are a little too quick, in my opinion, in our culture to let go of our guilt because of shame. Shame is a generalized sense of guilt just for existing. Actual situational guilt, that's like the pain that you experience when you cut your finger. It's a warning from the body that something is not right. He's talking about shame as being the thing that keeps us from making those connections, especially when there's been a failure. Shame that it's wrong that we take up space. Shame that it's wrong that we are here at all. Shame that we are ourselves. And of course, all of that is mostly untrue about us. But it gets in the way of saying, oh, I made a mistake. I need to repair with you. You may remember the story about restorative justice from earlier this year, about the young woman who was being eaten alive by her own anger, her totally justifiable anger at her abusive late father. And she happened to get an audience with the Dalai Lama. And he said, do you think you've been angry long enough? And she decided that she had been, so he suggested two things to her. Meditate. And she said, okay, I can do that. I can take a class. I can learn to meditate. And then he said, try to open your heart to your enemy. And she said, no, I can't do that. And he said, okay, just meditate. In fact, she was in law school at the time to become a lawyer to lock up people like her father who had done terrible things in the world. So the thought of opening her heart to those people just seemed insane to her. So she took a meditation class. And in the course of learning truly to meditate, she learned to open her heart, which meant learning the process of restorative justice, in which people who are ready sit down and talk through some pretty horrible things that they have done to each other and that they need to heal. Trying to figure out what that means in that moment. I think that means we're not going to have a restorative justice program here. But I also attended that ceremony at the African Burying Ground in Portsmouth yesterday. And that is one of the answers in my world right now for what do we do when we fail each other? What do we do when it seems like the door has closed? In the fall of 2003, some public service employees were digging up the street in downtown Portsmouth. I think there was a water main or something that needed attention. And my husband and I had just moved to Portsmouth and were enjoying the fact that we could walk from our little condo into town. And we walked by this big hole in the ground in which there were several people down there, including one who didn't look like a public service employee. And they were looking at the dirt with that, what do we do with this look? And we wondered what was going on and went on our way. Well, it turns out that those public service employees had found something much more than they had gone looking for. Their excavator had hit the wooden surface of a coffin, and they discovered that there were several down there. And I think what we saw was a couple of those public service employees and an archaeologist figuring out, how do we take this out of the ground well? So when they took that coffin and I think several remains of human beings out of the ground, they discovered that they had stumbled upon a graveyard that had been started in probably 1705. And after some DNA testing, they discovered that all of the people buried there were of African descent. They exhumed the remains of about 8 people, and over the next several years discovered that there were probably 200 people buried in that part of the downtown, most of them under the pavement of the street, some of them probably under the houses that are just a few feet away from the street. For about 200 years, African people were buried in what was then the outskirts of town. But the town grew and they paved it over. And now it has been refound and understood for what it is. And this is one of, I think, 2 recognized African burying grounds in the country. The other one is in Lower Manhattan. So over the course of a little more than a decade, groups of people in Portsmouth figured out how to honor this place, how to let the town be what it is and honor the people who are buried in this place. Those few remains that had been taken out of the ground were carefully prepared by an archaeologist and also by women of African heritage in Portsmouth. they planned a memorial. They closed that street. You can no longer drive down that street. They found an artist to create these beautiful sculptures. And they created a burial vault, which is covered with a Ghanaian symbol, which means go back and get it. People went back in time, essentially, and found this piece of, as someone said, not an African-American story and not a white story, but our story, and told it. And now it's part of town. You can walk through this memorial anytime, and you can walk along those words that Pat Yasha described and think about our history, not an African-American history and not a white history, but our history. So on Friday into Saturday, they had a consecration of the burial ground, and they reburied those remains. They had an all-night service for the people who would be reburied on Saturday morning. There was a sundown service, a midnight service, and a sunrise service. And then they brought these freshly made, handmade coffins. They're very small because they were built for bones. They brought those into town and they carried them down and reburied them under this beautiful covering for the vault that says, go back and get it. It was stunning to see this block that used to be just a busy little side street in downtown Portsmouth transformed into this place that honored a painful history, honored connections, that was both a burial place and a celebration of our capacity to tell the whole story, to make contact with each other in one of the most painful parts of our history. The fact that there was a slave market in Portsmouth and the graves of those people were paved over for years. And now we honor them. So I invite you wholeheartedly to go, as you have been invited twice already this morning, and see that place. It is a remarkable thing for our country to do. Because a lot of what we're hearing in the news these days about the inheritance of slavery is not about restoration, is not about honoring the fullness of the story, is not about going back and getting it. And it is easy to be entirely hopeless, to feel like the door is closed. But that burial ground, a 22-minute drive from here, tells another story of what's possible. The man who led the service of consecration on Saturday morning spoke part of the service in Igbo, and which is the Nigerian language that he first learned to speak, and then he translated into English. He said, "Well, I'll start it in Igbo, and then I'll try to translate for you in English. Is that all right?" The crowd cheered, which I thought was wonderful, that there was that sense of, yes, please go back and get it. He said, today we are carrying these bones to be placed in a cave of honor. We say we felt your pain. We felt what you went through. Fear not. Let your bones be still. Know that in this cave you will be remembered always. God grant them a peaceful resting place. I think that people had inklings that this burial ground was in this place before 2003. But either they couldn't figure out how to tell for sure that's what it was, or they just weren't ready yet, didn't have the capacity to tell the story and hear the story. And that is what we as a spiritual community do for each other and for the world. Build the capacity for those conversations between two people, between all people. And then I always get to this point of, how do we do that? How do we get ourselves to that point that we can have those conversations? The Dalai Lama encourages, and I've been mentioning it periodically, that having a meditation practice seems to be helpful in that area. And it seems to be true. People who learn to really meditate seem to have capacity for their own lives and for other people's lives that they didn't have before they started that. And I return to the wisdom of my colleague, because he describes it well, that hesitation, that catch in the heart. He says he's made a practice of listening for that in himself. He says that catch in the heart doesn't always mean you have to change course on what you're doing, but it does mean that there's something to pay attention to, either inside your own story or in the larger story. And that it starts by learning to pay attention to when your heart catches. He also talks about how useful it is when there can be a pause between how we first react to things and then how we actually communicate with other people. In an age of being overwhelmed by email, I hesitate slightly to say what I'm about to say, but sometimes email can be a great gift in this regard, because you don't just blurt it out. You have this moment when you write it out and then you look at it on the screen and think, And that pause can be the difference between making distance in a relationship and beginning restoration. And then the thing that he says that I love the most is a Zen line. He is a Buddhist. And it is, we are in one continuous mistake. Of course, the Zen Buddhists think that's delightful. I hear some of you laughing. And it frees you. It frees you from having to be right. You can't be. So just blunder along with the rest of us, making mistakes and doing our best to find ways to build relationship again with whoever we make contact with.